today we are going to hear from the Secretary of State's Audits Division. They're going to present the statewide single audit report, commonly referred, well, let's see, I think it's actually been referred to previously as the CAFR, or stood for Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. But anyway, this is a single audit report. This is a requirement of the federal government, and they take a look at some of our agencies. They're here to discuss this with us and sort of what it means and all that kind of stuff. So, Kathy, let me have you come up and bring your staff. And I think we do have some folks from DHS with us.
Nope.
No?
They're actually with me.
Oh, they're with you. Okay. Maybe we don't have anybody from DHS. But I think DHS and transportation kind of had the, well, and forestry, but we've already talked about forestry. Had some of the bigger issues. But Kathy, let me just go ahead and turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Kathy Polino with the Secretary of State Audits Division. Up here with me is Kelly Olson. She's one of our audit managers. Just a little bit of brief background on this. This is a report titled Statewide Single Audit Report. Many people have told me that this goes best with a glass of wine sitting by a fireplace. This is a fun and exciting read for most people.
And after the second glass of wine, you don't worry about what it says. You
it
just
gets
kind
a lot
of daze
more
off.
Exciting, but we won't go there. This is the largest audit that our office does every year. Just a little bit of background. At the peak of our season, we have about three-quarters of our staff that shift over and work on this particular audit. So at any given time, we might have 55 or so auditors working on this report. You will hear two different pieces to this, and just to clarify a little bit, this particular report in prior years has been called the Federal Compliance and Internal Control Report. We updated the name to kind of match up with what the national language is currently today. There's two pieces to this audit. The first piece we've talked about being the financial statement opinion audit work that we do on the state's comprehensive annual financial report. That particular report is published by the Department of Administrative Services. It's on their website. There is a single-page opinion that our office does, and it slides into that report. And so we do give an opinion on that particular report. This nice thick one is kind of the findings from our office, you know, doing that particular audit work. So you'll see sections in the report about financial findings, and that is our work that we do on the comprehensive annual financial report. You'll also see some findings in here about that are under this title of federal findings. Another piece of the work that we do is federal compliance work on behalf of the federal government. It's one of the conditions of our state receiving over $6 billion of federal funds is that our office does some work to kind of alert them if there's maybe some potential problems in the federal programs. So you'll hear when Kelly talks about what's all in this report, there's financial pieces and there's federal pieces to it, and there's a big difference for us and maybe not for a lot of other people. Just high level, the federal stuff, we are applying the guidance we get from the federal government, and we get compliance supplements from them. We use their criteria and we simply turn the results over to them, and it's up to them to decide what they do with the results. The financial stuff is our work, and we follow up on those, and those are the ones that are really important to us in particular. So just kind of the high level, the financial work we do go to maybe 15 or 16 agencies to do this work, and we audit somewhere in the neighborhood of 125, 130 accounts as we do that work. We do have many, many, many different people involved, so we did our best to bring the couple people we thought you might want to have questions to, but we may not have the expertise in the audience to answer all the questions that you might have, so we did come prepared to talk about Department of Human Services and the findings on the Public Employees Retirement System and Department of Administrative Services. But if there are other questions, we'll go ahead and take those and try to get back to you as soon as possible. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kelly to kind of walk you through the report itself. And then, Mr. Chair, we'll kind of leave it up to you if you want to ask questions at that time or if you want to come up and have the folks talk about the details of the other two sections. And, you know, we're kind of at your whim. So.
Okay, thank you.
Next.
Kelly?
Thank you. As Kathy said, I'm just going to kind of walk through what's in this report.
Kelly, for the record, I need you to state your name, please.
Okay. For the record, my name is Kelly Olson. I'm an audit manager with the Secretary of State Audits Division. As Kathy explained, I am going to just give you a quick overview of exactly what is in the report, and then we're going to turn it over for other audit managers to discuss the findings. One of the first things, as Kathy said, it contains our results of the financial statement audit and our federal compliance audit. We have two reports that we are required to publish. The report on the financial statements is found on page one, and it just goes over any internal control findings we found and any compliance findings. It is very standard language dictated by audit guidance that we have to say. On page three is our opinion on federal compliance audits. In it, it lists the programs that we contracted out for other auditors who actually did the work and reported the results back to us. So again, that is very standard language that is dictated by audit guidance. The next section is the schedule of expenditures of federal awards. This is information that agencies report to the Department of Administrative Services, and the Department of Administrative Services actually compiles and prepares the schedule. And our responsibility is we do some analytical procedures and take a look at it, but it is actually the department's responsibility to put it together. On the very last page of it, page 38, you will see that the state spent almost $6.2 billion in federal funds during fiscal year 2004. They break this down into different categories that are required by the federal government. This is how the federal government wants this money reported to them. Right after that is just some notes that, again, is required by the federal government for us to report to them. So, as Kathy said, a lot of this is dictated by what the federal government wants, because a lot of what's in here is federal expenditures. On page 56, just to point out something that you may want to know, is a list of the 15 actual federal programs that we audited or contracted to have audited for fiscal year 2004. These programs were selected based on guidance provided by the federal government. They give very detailed instructions on how to select programs, and that's what we follow. And then when you move into the next section, we start reporting current year findings. These are findings as a result of the work during fiscal year 2004 on the agencies we went to if they had findings. The first section are the financial statement findings, which again were related to our results of the state of Oregon's financial statements. The next section, when you move over, is the result of our findings related to federal programs. As Kathy alluded to, we do the federal award findings on page 81 as a result of guidance that the federal government provides. They give a lot of guidance. And so they have different, what they call compliance requirements that they, depending on the program, may be applicable to the program that we have to audit against. And so some of the times when you see terminology, it is their terminology. An example of a requirement that we may test is eligibility, whether the people who received the funds were eligible to receive, and that's something the federal government wants to know, and whether the costs that the agency expended were allowable, and that's per federal guidance as to what costs are allowable.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Butler.
Question, Kelly, if I may, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Kelly, so when you test, for instance, the Department of Human Services, Health and Human Services, state, and you find that a variance in your overall report that you have instance, does the if you find that there's a 0.2% weakness on $100 million, that starts to add up into some money. Do we then automatically have rebates that are due to the federal government, or do they allow a certain standard by which we can have some variance?
Chair Cumrell, Representative Butler, part of that is the federal government. They will follow up on any costs that may be questioned. They give us guidance. One of the thresholds they have, and one of the things I was going to mention in here, you'll see like a question cost of $108. What the federal government requires is that we look at it, because we only select a sample. Mm-hmm. We don't look at everything.
Right.
And that we project it to the population. If the likely question costs are going to exceed $10,000, they require us to report the finding. And then it is up to them to follow up on the finding and determine what, if anything, will happen. They don't always require the agency to reimburse them.
So follow up.
Follow up.
So if from the sample you get a variance, and the variance times the total population is $10,001, then the federal government sorts that out with mm-hmm. the agency themselves.
Yes.
They don't obviously have you come in and be their collector.
No.
And when you go through nearly 30 pages of federal grants for one fiscal year amounting to $6.2 billion, how many variances did you find that would have exceeded the $10,000? Do you remember any chance?
I would have to go through the findings and count up. Each one, if there's a question cost, is noted in the title of the finding.
In the title of the findings, which I would find on page, starting on 81.
Yeah, if you look on starting on page 81, each finding starts with 04-16 is one finding.
Okay.
And 04-17 is a separate finding. And in the title in bold, if there are question costs, it will so state in the title.
So it goes from that point to what, 43?
It goes from 81 to page 99.
Yeah, so 0433 would be the last of those points. So we could find where there was potentially weaknesses in internal control or weaknesses in the expenditure authority. By just looking at pages 81 through 99.
That is correct.
Okay. The statistical weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And then kind of what I've explained, again, going back to the federal programs, is because the feds do it, and I touched on how some of the findings get reported, even though it's a very small dollar amount. Some of it is, for example, just to touch on 04-16, even though it says $8 million, if you read the findings, there was an issue that the contract auditor had that they weren't able to tell. So the Fed requires to report the whole amount. It's not that the whole amount is unallowable. It's just that we couldn't tell. So just some warning on some of the question costs. It's not automatically all question. Starting on page 100, another requirement of the federal government is that we have to continue to report prior year findings, both financial statements and federal programs, for the next 2 years until the agency either reports the status as corrective action taken or we may have carried it forward into the current year. So when you look at findings starting from page 100, these are financial statement findings related to the prior fiscal year. And all we're doing is the agency has reported the status of the finding to date at that point in time, and we are required, the audits division, to follow up and make sure we agree with the status that has been reported. So it goes through all of the financial statement findings for the prior year and also the federal program findings for the prior year. And then,
Chair, Representative Butler.
One question, Kelly. I thought I read in the opening premise as to what the scope would be was on page one. We did not audit the financial statements, the components of the university system, and yet it appears that there may be university payments that are in the scope of your testing. When you look at some of the payments that would appear to be through the university systems, the
pass-through awards.
Pass-through awards. Do you test the university systems' pass-through awards?
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, yes. If you read that, it's standard language. What we're doing, if you read it, is we personally, the audits division, did not audit the university system, but we are relying upon the work of auditors that we have contracted who did that work.
So whose sample were these taken from, untested, these pass-through awards? Were they even sampled?
The, if you look on page 56, the federal program that was audited for the university system was the Student Financial Assistance
Okay.
Class.
All right.
And they did not have any findings related to that federal program.
Amongst those 16, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Amongst those 16 on page 56, then do we know which of those did have findings? By looking at the NA indicates is an indication of finding or not finding. Is there a way that we can check those off of those 16 on that page that had findings? Or we still are relegated back to pages 81, beginning with the findings and question cost.
Representative Cromwell, Representative Butler, that is correct. It would be in the title of the finding.
Okay. Right.
Just a quick overview. If the program had no findings, you will not see it included in the findings section.
Right.
But we have to list for the federal government all programs audited because they want to know what we looked at.
Just one follow-up, if I may, and this probably, but it's a question that I just came across. I've got amongst the federal grants and awards, some of them are a matter of just a few dollars, and so if your statistical sample called one of those up that was a very small amount, I'm assuming to make the sample pure, you keep that in the sample. But if you've got a grant award, for instance, a state wildlife or a state wildlife grant, let's pick another one, administrative grant, federal aid in sport and wildlife fishing of $1,203 of a federal award, and you find, and that comes up in your findings, obviously you're not going to come up with a $10,000 total unless you were to extrapolate that and say if this is one fraction of this total $1,203 times the amount $6.2 billion, then that could be a very significant finding. Does that work, or how do you sort that out, or do you just unsample that and come back and revitalize your statistical sample population?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Butler, that's a very good question. Part of what I didn't get into because it's very technical is in the federal guidance as to which programs we select. They set thresholds that you calculate times the federal expenditures that the state actually did. And so if for the state of Oregon, I believe if it's less than $1.8 million, we do not do what we call a risk assessment around the federal program. So the federal government only requires that we risk assess programs that are greater for this year that are greater than $1.8 million.
Mr. Chair, I think I just found a way to make myself very wealthy. But don't as long as I say less than $1.8 million in a program.
Yes.
Now, I'm sure that you've got plenty of other internal control to keep that from happening.
So then, Kelly, is that that 1.8? I just happened to notice that on page 56 would be about 10% of the dollar threshold to distinguish between type A and type B programs. Is there a relationship, or is that just coincidence?
Representative Chair Cromwell, there is a relationship. There are certain percentages and things that they require us to multiply it against, and you know, I was giving the 1.8. It's not exact, but that's about where it is.
Mm-hmm.
The amount you'll see in here on page 56, the $18 million, that is the threshold to distinguish between the very large programs and then the smaller programs below the $18 million and between the $1.8 million. The programs greater than $18 million are required to be audited by the federal government once every 3 years, no matter what.
Okay.
So they focus on the larger dollar amounts.
Okay.
And just one of the things I wanted to clarify for Representative Butler is the NA found on page 56. The reason there's no number there is because the program is what the federal government calls a cluster, and it is made up of multiple federal programs. And so instead of listing all of them, you just put NA.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Rosenbaum has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, when you find deficiencies, then are they bound by
what your findings are? Are they bound to correct them?
Chair Crummell, Representative Rosenbaum, when it's a federal program, they are not bound by our finding. They may very well disagree with our finding, and because we're doing this on behalf of the federal government, it is the federal government's responsibility to follow up and determine what they want done with the finding. Mm.
Thank you.
Kelly, before you move on, Jim had raised a question, and actually I'm going to ask him to ask it because he's the one that has brought it to my attention, and he's going to understand it better than I am. So, Jim?
Well, the second question we had talked about, you just responded to, which that was a good answer. And then going back to the start of page 7, there are a number of programs as we go through it that has a minus number. And if you could tell us how that becomes a minus number, you know, what circumstances might create that?
Chair Crummell, committee administrator. part of that is I would have to ask the Department of Administrative Services and the agency for sure. So at this point, I'm going to kind of tell you what we think happens with it. Usually those are very small dollar amounts. And some of it is the agency may have done an adjustment after last year and reduce their expenditures. And so if they didn't have anything to reduce it against, it shows up as negative. As a piece, we kind of rely on the Department of Administrative Services to look at it when it's a very small dollar amounts. We focus on the larger programs and analytics that we do, and if there's a very big discrepancy, like between the current year and the prior year, those are the ones we follow up on for programs we didn't audit.
Mr. Chair, I think our best guess is it's a timing issue, that you would have seen it in the prior year as a positive number, and this was a negative against that amount. It's just a timing of when that adjustment took place.
But okay. Yeah.
Any specific ones, we can ask some questions if there are some.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Butler.
And if there are known deficiencies or whistleblowing that goes on, no matter at what level, how do those get included in your overall sample for the CAFR report for auditing? If there are publicized deficiencies for a very small agency that doesn't require, statistically doesn't come up on your radar screens, or one of the larger agencies above the AB cutoff, For distinguishing the size of programs that you've just audited in year one, and year two you have a whistleblower that says there's serious defalcation here. How do you speed that up in that process, either for the greater or less than?
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, as far as I'm aware, we haven't had a whistleblower around a federal program issue. I know we may have some around another, but it's not specific that for this program they're doing this. So some of those would be follow-up in our investigation unit. For some, if it was very specific to a federal program, that is something we can look at. As it hasn't happened, I'm sure we would bring it forward, but also the federal government, though they rely on us to do this every year, they also come into a lot of these agencies on a regular basis and do some other more maybe in-depth or expanded looks at programs that we may not have looked at.
So I understand, they send in their own people when there might be that issue and you're not certain of it one way or the other.
No.
But how do you call it to their attention? Is there an additional management letter?
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, if we were to get something like that, we would have to inform the federal government that we had such an allegation around a specific federal program.
But to clarify, Mr. Chair, you've never received a notice of a whistleblower on any federal program. $6.2 billion a year.
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, they may have, but when they make the call, they don't make it specific
to that federal program.
Yeah.
So you handle that through the regular audit channel.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, maybe another follow-up on that is, while there is really prescription of what we need to look at, there is some flexibility built into it. And so those you know, we do have to audit all the ones that are above the threshold, but then we get to pick and choose which ones from the stuff that's below the threshold that we audit each year. And so if there was a smaller program that, you know, kind of came to our attention, that's one that I would assume that we would kind of insert in the next year and fill out our requirements. So there is some flexibility in which programs we choose to audit.
Mr. Chair, this may or may not be the time to ask, but I think it's we've talked about Kathy and Kelly. We've talked about the possibility of the devolution of some services back to the counties. If county governments wanted to participate in some programs, Kansas has been very successful in this most recently of being able to go in and through the process of devolution, have counties pick up certain programs that previously and heretofore had been state programs operated from the state, managed all from the state level, and then grants and those kinds of things going out to the various counties. Then the counties, as they contract for mental health services or other kinds of human service programs, then they're subject to their audit. You share that audit and report back. Kansas had been able to devolve itself from some of that, actually passed some of its rights to the federal money out to the counties. County auditors were then required to come back and make the same kinds of CAFRA attestations that you folks are making here. The question I have is, how difficult would that be in the state of Oregon? Obviously, Kansas has done it. The benefit is, number one, you have a program where you're working with people that need the services at the county level as opposed to trying to administer and manage all of the issues, every issue that comes up, whether the county that begins with M is not here, Marion, or Multnomah, those problems are handled locally. My question is, and incidentally, they do get the 60 cents on the federal dollar, or the 60 cents on the local dollar, so that they get a 150% match, basically, on those dollars. And they must administer those, they must have that attestation from the state level, too, because that's got to be included in your CAFRA report, because those are federal dollars. How difficult would that be for your shop to be able to administer that kind of a program in the state of Oregon, similar to what they do in Kansas? The benefit, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. is that we found that in Kansas, and we've now discovered that in many of the, particularly here in the Valley, many of the programs administered here, the human services programs, have a fairly significant local general fund match. I say match, general fund dollars being invested from property taxes. So if you put $1 million of property tax money into a program, then you would be entitled under the Kansas model of $1.5 million additional money, which is already on the ground, which the first dollar of which goes right to the people who they're trying to serve and benefit and work for. And so it's a very, very effective model of parlaying local dollars and then making sure that those local dollars, and the concern that I have is to make certain that we have the ability to attest for that if we were to, through the process of devolution, allow our counties to use some of their local money, and we will be responsible to account for it.
Okay.
So that's, would it be, how difficult are we talking about here?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Butler, part of it depends, if I'm understanding correctly, what I'm hearing is instead the money, instead of coming from the federal government to us and then to the counties, would go directly to the counties?
But the state government then still has the responsibility of attesting to the federal government that the money went for the programs and for the services that it was originally designed. It just skips the step of the money stopping at the state level before it gets to the county. Actually, I think probably the check actually is written through and goes straight through, but the county must attest to the amount of services that are being provided.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Butler, part of that is already happening. If you look on page 38 of the Schedule of Expenditures of Federal Awards, the column that says amounts provided to subrecipients, that is money that went to outside of the state and went most likely to the city, a county, municipality, or some other entity who actually may provided the service. In those cases, the agency that sent the money out has requirements to monitor the entity at a higher level to ensure that they spent the money as they were supposed to. Those entities are then also required to have a single audit if they have federal expenditures in total greater than $500,000.
So most counties, Mr. Chair, as I hear what Kelly's saying, most counties have to make that examination already of their books, because most counties would be in excess of $500,000 of federal funds.
Right.
That being the case, and when I talk about counties, I'm talking about those programs that are administered through the state with the county commissioners as our local partners for the delivery of those services. So we rely upon our county commissioners to go ahead and attest back in their audit that, in fact, the programs are met, and your local auditors at that point make that attestation that they were, in fact, used. So if we've already got nearly $900 million of the $6.2 billion that's being attested to in that fashion, then it really shouldn't be difficult for us to maybe tack on at some point to the Kansas model.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Butler, there's a piece that depends. It's hard for me to say for sure how difficult it would be. A lot of that is going to rest with state agencies rather than us as the auditors. If the feds send the money directly to the county, we have no responsibility as the Secretary of State for that money, because it did not come through.
That's why I drew that L, Kelly.
Yeah.
I drew that L because it lands at the state and then it gets devolved out. That would have to be a state policy change, and certainly you're going to have a culture change within the agencies, because they'll want to go ahead and say, no, we're going to administer that up here. We're not going to allow you to administer that. And so there is a culture change in that process. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. We've talked about this for probably 4 years. In the meantime, Kansas has gone ahead and done it in the meantime, and has been very successful in helping people that really needed the help in Health and Human Services.
So has Representative Butler, has Kansas then found that their administrative costs actually went down and more dollars are actually getting on the ground as far as helping the people that the money's intended to help?
Mr. Chair, I don't know about the cost at the state level, and that's why I asked Kelly about this cost at the state level and the difficulty of administering that from the audit function. The programs are identical, and the program delivery is identical. The issue is that we find that there are local dollars actually being expended in addition to the money that comes presently from the federal government through the state after administration costs then are block granted or are granted back out to the counties for the various delivery systems and programs. Mm-hmm. So what it is that when you determine that, in fact, there is $1 million being expended on top of the $10 million that we're accounting for being passed through to them, if we find that there's $1 million of local property tax money that is also put in a program that is for delivering mental health services to those folks who need the mental health services under the federal guidelines, then we find that $1 million that they put in of local property tax money can then be added to $1.5 million. The state continues to attest to the fact that $1 million was expended locally, and that the 1.5, which they then received for matched dollars, was also appropriately expended. So what it does is it matches that $1 million to make it into $2.5 million, but the first dollar of it is already, you're already serving the people in the field.
Right.
And so the first dollar goes for services, and it just basically, it's a way to, in effect, create some synergism between the state's dollars and the local dollars matched with those federal dollars, and it really can be very effective in that process. As I say, if we have some of this attestation function now going on for the accountability, then it would take some cultural change. That's not these folks' venue, but it would take some cultural change on the part of some state agencies. It will also take some cultural change on the part of some local agencies, because they would have to be better stewards of the accountability locally. But I just wondered, in the administration cost, excellent point, Mr. Chair, I just wondered what the administration cost was at the state level in trying to trying to ferret this out and actually account for it and the overall audit function, then we would have to look at the other administrative functions at the state level as we devolve that.
Okay. Going back, we were starting to talk about that there are the prior fiscal year financial findings mm-hmm. located in the report, and those are reported until corrective action is taken. The fiscal year 2003 and 2002 financial findings start on page 100, and then the federal programs start on page 112. And so those are also there and reported to the federal government until the status is corrective action taken, and then they drop off. Only 2 years is required to be reported if we believe it is still a finding, and if it's a financial statement, we will most likely write a current year finding on it. If it's a federal program and the federal agency has issued a decision that it's not a finding, we will let it drop off. What happens to this program, this report, is here in March we do some technical stuff that the federal government wants us to do, and we basically send a package to them. It goes to every federal agency that has a finding in this report, and then they have 6 months to issue a decision to the state agency on what they want. So that's kind of what happens to the report.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. In regards to that, have you ever had a federal agency say, you know, we're not going to send through any more payments until you know, resolve these issues? I mean, has there ever been times where we've had federal money held up?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Dingfelder, that would be in relation to Department of Human Services Medicaid program. When they had the Medicaid upper payment limit finding, mm-hmm. The feds did make some decisions on that, but that was their decision.
Just a follow-up.
Follow-up.
So that was, and that was regarding the court case. They were waiting until, mm-hmm. yeah, resolution of the court case. But as far as just saying, you know, until you fix these problems, we've never had that issue come up.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Dingfelder, as far as I'm aware, no. A lot of times what the federal government wants to do is if it's something that they feel is important, a lot of times they'll set corrective action and they'll mm-hmm. monitor the agency to make sure they're coming to compliance.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Does that conclude your portion at this,
yeah,
at this point?
Yeah, we're here, Mr. Chair. Like I mentioned earlier, we do have someone here that can talk about the specific findings of the Department of Human Services or the Public Employees Retirement System. We were just guessing what you might be interested in hearing, but it's kind of up to you on where you'd like to go.
Okay. I actually would like to ask the folks that have done the stuff with Human Services if they can come up and just kind of address some of the findings a little bit. One of the reasons is because this is such a huge area for us, and the amount of federal dollars are. Thank you, Kelly. Maybe you could just go ahead and start off by, well, first of all, of course, identify yourself for the record, but then just kind of go through a little bit of some of the findings that you found with the Department of Human Services, and go from there.
Chair Cromwell, members of the committee, my name for the record is Neil Weatherspoon. I'm the audit administrator that this past year was in charge of the Department of Human Services portion of the statewide audit. And to my right is Julie Kennedy, who was the in-charge auditor. And just give you a little bit of background of you know, you're right. It's a tremendous chunk of auditing that gets done at the Department of Human Services and many very complex federal programs and lots of dollars that affect our comprehensive annual financial report. And so we effectively have two big audits that go on. First, this year, we did the financial work. Then after that financial work for the comprehensive annual financial report was accomplished and done, then we went in and did specific federal compliance work too. And you see the results of both of those essentially in this report when it comes to internal control findings and then findings regarding federal compliance. And in the past, we've had a number. So as you look through the report, you're going to see scattered throughout, both in prior years' findings and in current years' findings, those that relate to Department of Human Services. To give you just a little bit of background regarding the, first of all, the financial type or internal control findings that we had. And we had a couple of three, you know, major ones that we'd like to discuss with you a little bit. A little over a year ago, Department of Human Services went through a massive organizational change, as you're aware of, making, you know, several agencies into one. That task was monumental. To have, you know, that and continue business at the same time. So we did, you know, a considerable amount of audit work this past year starting about this time to look at how that process went and to ensure that we were comfortable with the numbers that would be consolidated into that one agency in what, you know, a monumental task. With that, there were a couple of findings that came up through, you know, that process and through the process of our statewide financial work that we did. One was a financial internal control finding relating to cash reconciliations.
Can you tell us what page that's on?
58,
okay. Yeah. I'm trying to get to the right place.
I believe. One of the assigned accounts that we had this year, and our accounts that are assigned for us as auditors of that agency, they change every once in a while. And that's because of the total amounts and the materiality of the accounts, you know, point us in. And also because of the new standards that we have encourage us to alter, you know, our path, and so that we're not always auditing the same account or the same few accounts that are the big ones, you know, and so we'll change things up a little bit to ensure that we've given good coverage. And this year we audited an account that we hadn't audited before, and that was a few cash accounts over there within the general fund. A piece of that was some cash accounts. There's numerous cash, you know, it's list as long as your arm of the physical accounts, you know, that supply funds for these particular different programs. They have to segregate them out to ensure that there isn't some commingling and that sort of thing. And so within the general fund, we were looking at a cash account in specific that was in suspense. That means cash where, you know, you haven't quite determined yet where the money should go for some reason or another. And those are quite risky accounts for us to see cash in suspense. And so as we were looking at those particular cash accounts and doing our audit work, we noted that about 90% of them had not been reconciled. And in order to get to the figure that we could feel comfortable with for our statewide financial report, we found some instances where some fairly significant material adjustments needed to be made in order to make that number fall within our tolerable error limit. Because of that, and the fact that there were no reconciliations performed on approximately 9% of those particular types of accounts, we felt that was a material weakness that needed to be taken care of. Then we also saw, and as we looked at cash and cash handling, that there was some difficulties that the agency was having with segregation of duties, and they indicated to us that a lot of that was some staffing issues, but we were having a single person opening lots of checks and having control over that cash for periods of time, and we weren't feeling comfortable with that. Good internal control practices would indicate that you'd have at least two people handling cash and checks and things like that during those processes. So that also was a internal control finding that we brought up.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Neil, is this a statewide issue, or is it just in certain offices? Where did you find the segregation of duties issues being a problem?
Chair Cremel and Representative Butler, the issues that we found there and that we were addressing were in their central office. Most of these monies were sent to a central location. So,
Mr. Chair, I find that to be just a little bit disconcerting. We didn't have that much cut in central office. I could see it if it was out in a Bend office or a Hood River office, but I'm surprised that they would modify their segregation of duties over cash handling at the main office where most of the payments are being received. Is that an ongoing, is this an ongoing repeat audit item, or is this the first time this issue has cropped up with this department?
Chair Cremel and Representative Butler, good question. One of the things is this was a new account. And so we hadn't audited, this particular account before, and or that, particular process. But we, this isn't a new thing. This, I don't believe that the from my experience at the department, that their staff was actually reduced in this area. It was probably just never sufficient to take care of that particular duty and responsibility.
Mr. Chair,
yes, sir.
We set these accounts up for new accounts, as Neil has indicated, Mr. Weisbrun has indicated. When you get a new account or new activity, I'm hopeful that the managers that we're hiring to take care of these kinds of programs are folks that understand the importance of internal control. And that may speak to yet another deficiency, and I don't know, maybe that's something else that lends itself not to a financial audit, but to a performance audit of some sort. I just would hope that we're hiring people who have management skills when they're hired to manage a new department, a new activity, which has a new account, that they understand that you have certain internal control procedures. Again, that appears that they should have gone to the Oregon Accounting Manual, which would undoubtedly tell them that you've got to have these various checks and balances in place before you begin to receive resources.
One of the things that I noted in this, and I don't remember if it was this one or not, but there was, maybe it was in corrections, but that their Oregon Accounting Manual actually that they had on site was outdated. I guess
that's
that was
shocking.
That was in the Department of Corrections.
But going any versions of it.
But going back to the segregation of duties issue, I noted, Neil, in the agency's response, something that sort of stuck out at me. This is, while it is true that there may not be adequate separation of cash receiving duties, compensating controls are in place. Did the agency by any chance address with you or talk with you at all about what they felt were their compensating controls that would evidently not make this as, I mean, what I'm reading into that is that it's not a big issue. And I was just wondering if
new system of internal control.
Yeah. Is it if in there, when your exit took place and your interviews and that sort of thing, if they mentioned that or said anything about it, and whether or not you found their compensating controls to be adequate or inadequate or a kind of a, well, we'll see.
Chair Crummell, I believe, you know, the best answer to that would be, yes, we had a lot of discussion with the agencies regarding all of the findings and lots of discussion. We even, you know, they did indicate that they were doing things, you know, and they felt, you know, were adequate for that. From, you know, a perspective of internal control and cash, though, when it comes to one of the primary controls, you know, that's always expected with cash and cash handling is dual custody. And we feel that dual custody is absolutely necessary, that there are real no compensating controls for a lack of dual custody, because at that point, because it's at the beginning, and so if only one person opens the mail and has the check or the cash in their hand and no one else knows about it, then you don't know whether or not mm-hmm. that got recorded.
Right.
And so that was the stance that we took. We used as our criteria not only, you know, the Oregon Accounting Manual specifically states in it that very fact, and it's well known among the industry and the auditing world that is an internal control or a cash that you just don't mess with. So,
yes, Representative.
I have a question. I mean, this seems like a fairly basic, you know, type of procedure. I mean, it's not something that, you know, most nonprofits I know and corporations would have that type of concern. If this was happening, and the question I had was, this was caught by an external auditor versus an internal auditor, and I mean, I would imagine DHS must have several internal auditors. Hmm. So, can you just explain how this was detected?
Yes, Chair Crummell and Representative Dingfelder. Essentially, yes, our audit team found, you know, that particular internal control weakness. They do have internal auditors, and I'd hate to speak for them. There very well could have been, you know, some action or some knowledge on their part. I believe, you know, from the response of the agency, and I'd hate to speak for the agency, I think that they would be, you know, be better to probably answer that question, but from their response and the feeling that we had is that they had, you know, they were feeling that they were doing what they could, you know, to take care of this risk, and it was a risk that they were willing to shoulder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I just want to comment on this because the Department of Human Services does have an internal audit unit, but they have a completely impossible task to really do a good job for an agency this large. I feel sorry for them. So they do go through kind of a risk assessment process, and they try to focus their resources on, you know, kind of the bigger picture of things that they think they can impact. I know one of the things that they do is kind of have contact with us so that if there's something that we may be looking at, they may shift their resources someplace else. But again, you know, some of these are some very basic controls that you do want to have in the agency. And so, you know, they are basic, but I want to give them a little bit of leeway because it is a huge task. I mean, I feel for them every day that I talk to them. So.
Thank you, Kathy.
Okay, thank you. Was there a sample, Neil, as far as the amount of cash that we're talking about in this issue, cash and checks and that sort of thing? Do we have any idea?
Chair Crummell, I believe, you know, let me defer that to Julie Kennedy who is the in charge, and she may be able to give you some, or she could correct me maybe. I seem to remember, you know, through that process that we were looking within that suspense, you know, area somewhere in the neighborhood of, was it 80 million? I believe so, you know, in total. That was going through that suspense. And let me kind of explain the reason why, you know, that would be so large. And it had, a lot of it had to do with the mechanisms in which the state is were handling payments through the Department of Human Services. It's one of those instances where when funds are expended, they go through and are paid really essentially out of the general fund, all of them, and then being reimbursed out of federal funds when those are reported. And so on one hand, as the checks go out, they're going out of a system that is not our financial system.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but a particular agency system that will do, you know, say for instance, welfare or Medicaid or one of those things. And so there's a cash a payment system that generates the check, and then at some point, you know, it has to, it'll go into this pot of of suspense, and then matched up as it clears Treasury. To be effectively put into our statewide financial management application, our financial book, so to speak, and to be put in the right slot or right account. When that reconciliation in most agencies is automated. At the Department of Human Services, because of how monies were coming in from all these different cash payment systems, that many of those were not automated. And so, you know, it would require the agency to go through the process of linking this up. And so it was kind of an onerous task, of which, you know, they were trying to deal with. And they're at present time, you know, working with Department of Administrative Services to make that a simpler process and more automated. So we're hopeful on that this will be, you know, a prior audit finding and not, you know, an ongoing thing.
Okay, thank you. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Was there anything else that you wanted to...
There was, you know, leading into kind of, you know, some of the other things that we had indicated, and okay, those were the first two financial type audit findings that we found. However, we had a prior audit findings on internal control that we found to be ongoing and not fully resolved, and that had to do, and that's on page, I believe, 100.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a general accounting weakness. So here we got cash and segregation of duties over cash, and then we had more of a general finding over internal control that we were indicating that we were having difficulty having a full assurance that everything was getting done. And the reason why this general accounting type finding or weakness is still ongoing is that in the past, when we've audited there, during our audit process, our auditors have found material errors that if they would have been, you know, reported as, you know, originally, you know, intended by the agency, would have resulted in an error that would have been misleading to the report. Okay, and so whenever our folks who are attesting to the statements would find those types of errors and have to require or suggest to the agency that they correct them before the statements are published, we would say that would be a material internal control weakness that we would want, because it's actually the agency and the state's responsibility to make sure that those statements have no material misstatements within them, no material error. And so this year, as in years past, we had a number of such adjustments that we had to or suggested to the agency that they take care of. And so when we see that, the whole intent of internal control, of course, is to make sure there are no such instances. When we do find them, then it's an indication to us that the problem has not yet been solved. And so that was an ongoing, and we indicated that they have, you know, been working on it, but it's still, because of those adjustments we had to suggest this year, it's still an ongoing process. It then, if you know, through, you know, the federal compliance, since we had lots of federal compliance programs and very large programs that we audited, there are a number of things that we had through that section of the report. One of the major programs that we looked at specifically this year, because it's kind of on a rotational basis, but this one was one that you'll probably see every year, and that's the temporary assistance to needy families, or sometimes called TANF.
Excuse me, what page is that on?
86. There's actually several findings on that particular program, 86, 89, 91, and 92, having to do with, you know, some federal requirements that are there for the program. On page 86 is one on cash management. On 89, it had, and 91, having to do with maintenance of effort, and that's the amount of state dollars that are required to be expended in order to get, you know, federal funds. And then on 92, there's a finding on question costs. And although, you know, one side note, although the question costs are, like Kelly indicated a little earlier, are like $4,000, the sample is relatively small. The population is huge. And so when you extrapolate those, they certainly go past that $10,000 limit in some of these instances. If you were to extrapolate them to the full population, they could be in the millions of dollars.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum, yes.
Thanks a lot. I was going to ask you, actually, about the maintenance of effort, so I'm glad that you brought it up. Are you the primary auditors, then, that are looking at whether we're accurately accounting for the maintenance of effort funds?
Chair Crummell and Representative Rosenbaum, that's correct. You know, one of the requirements of a single audit is to make sure that the federal requirements are being met, and one of those is maintenance of effort. And I could give you a little bit of sidelight to this, and it may, you know, explain it a little bit regarding, you know, what specifically we had a problem with. It's one of those instances where the agency, as I said before, when they make expenditures to, you know, that particular program, it's really effectively going out of the general fund, and then they, you know, ask for a federal reimbursement. And since, you know, the maintenance of effort is one of those issues where they had to spend somewhere in the neighborhood of $91 million in every given year in order to get additional federal funds. And anything over that $91 million is effectively all federal funded. And so, and they have, excuse me, somewhere in the neighborhood of a couple hundred million dollars that go out of the program, and so there's a lot of federal dollars. If you do not make the maintenance of effort, if you do not spend, you know, during that given year, the $91 million, then they decrease the amount of federal funds that they'll, to bring you up to that $91 million. Okay, and so the mechanism is that since it's a set amount, they really don't effectively know, or it's difficult to gauge exactly when they're going to get to that $91 million. And they want to be good stewards of the state's monies, and they want to make it, you know, so it's kind of even for us through that. So they do an estimate of what they believe, you know, will be, will get them to that, you know, the funding split between federal and state dollars. And so they'll request federal dollars as they go along, at like a 60-40 split or a 70-30 split, or whatever they think will get them to the $91 million by the end of the year. Then at the end of the year, when they gather in all of their data from the many places throughout the state, because this is not, you know, localized to necessarily the Department of Human Services, some of these funds for that program can come from, like, the employment department and other places. I believe some comes from maybe a university system, having to do a training for welfare recipients and things like that. So that maintenance of effort, you know, in order to put that, you know, report together, and it's required by a certain time, they make an adjustment then to make sure that they meet the maintenance of effort, you know, at the end of the year, and they do not exceed it, because we don't want to have more state dollars used when they could be federal dollars. In that process, though, when they go and draw the federal funds, those are federal expenditures. And then, of course, the state expenditures that we have through, you know, that adjustment process, you know, will be the remainder. Our problem was that they got to the end of the year, they reported to the feds that they met the maintenance of effort, but at that time had not made the adjustment, and the adjustment is the mechanism for which they actually make the state expenditure for federal dollars that had already, say, you know, to give you an example, if you have $100 million, your maintenance of effort, say, is $60 million. At the end of the year, they may have already drawn $70 million in federal funds that would require them to give $10 million back. And until they make that adjustment that gives the $10 million back, they have not met their maintenance of effort. And that's effectively the thing. So we saw in the years past that they were a little tardy on making that adjustment and actually spending, you know, the state dollars. And within, you know, a reasonable range, that's okay. However, this one was done months after the fact. And so we had not really made the state expenditure until, in one instance, I think February, April, when the end of the federal fiscal year was September. And so we're effectively using the Fed's dollars, you know, during that point, and also, which would be kind of a cash management issue, but also we had not actually made the state expenditure for that given period, you know, to meet the maintenance of effort.
So follow up. So was there a consequence to that?
Representative Crummell Representative Crummell and Representative Rosenbaum, and the consequence is they have an audit finding, of which, you know, the feds then will go in and determine. For, you know, the past years where the adjustment was made late, they actually did, you know, give back to the feds, you know, the in one instance, like about $8 million, I believe. And so, you know, the consequence with the feds, you know, will determine what, you know, how meaningful that is to them that they got it late. This year, though, at the time of our audit, they had not done it for the past year.
And final follow-up.
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you. So I believe also, though, that certain things like tax credits, like the working family child care credit, can count toward maintenance of effort, too. I think when we made that a refundable credit, we talked about that. Are you in a position to look at whether things that can be counted as well as things that are being counted or are being accurately taken advantage of?
Good question, Chair Crummell and Representative Rosenbaum. In this instance, what we look at is effectively not what could have happened, but what did happen. And so we have to ascertain that the reports that they filed to the federal government regarding the program and the expenditures they made were appropriate. Now, there, in any instance, could be opportunities there, but we don't look at the opportunities lost.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Are there any other questions for Neil? Neil, is there anything else that you wanted to discuss with us on this?
Not at this time. Thank you so much for the opportunity to enlighten you with this.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Appreciate it very much. Mm-hmm. What I would like to do is, it looks like we might have a little work to do with the Human Services Department, but what I would like to do is, now if I can find my notes,
there were some issues around the public employees retirement system, and you said that, Kathy, that you brought the folks with you from PERS, or not from PERS, but from your office that dealt with written rule. And so, I don't know if you want to give us a little quick overview on what you found with the public employees retirement system, but I do have a couple of specific questions as well. But.
Okay, Chair Crummell, members of the committee, I'll just kind of go through and summarize the finding on a really high level and then allow you to answer or ask any questions that you have. Basically,
for the record, I need
you to for the say. Record, my name is Amy Palacios. I'm a senior auditor with the Secretary of State Audit Division.
Thank you.
The last couple years, while auditing the public employee retirement system, we have had this particular finding as an issue that we have not made a reportable condition because the dollar thresholds involved were not that large. This year, the dollar threshold kind of made us a little bit uncomfortable, and so that's how it ended up as a reportable condition this year in the single audit report. What that condition is there are some clearing accounts, three in particular, that we did not feel PERS was reconciling or clearing those reconciling items timely.
And this is the information on page 60?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 60 and 61. The total unreconciled balance of the three accounts that we looked at exceeded $285 million as an absolute value. When you net the amounts out, it comes to a little bit less. It's about $193 million that you'll actually see. But the value of those reconciling items is what we were more concerned with, and that was the $285 million as of the end of the fiscal year, June 30, 2004. Of that amount, $140 million, or almost half, had remained in those clearing accounts for more than 1 year, and that was our biggest concern, was that PERS was not addressing the fact that there were these reconciling items. They were getting very old. The older they get, the more difficult they could be to research and clear and determine whether or not it's an appropriate reconciling item, whether the amount of benefits actually being paid out or the amount in the member's account is accurate, or whether the reconciling item represents a discrepancy that needs to be fixed. To talk a little bit more about the reconciliation accounts, items are placed in these clearing accounts when there's a disagreement between the amounts reported in the membership and benefit reserve subsystems of the Retirement Information Management System, which is the main system that PERS has used in the past for maintaining membership information, calculating the retirements, and then storing the reserve information for once a member has retired. So when there's differences in the subsystems, that's what results in these clearing accounts that we're talking about.
Okay. Is I'm going to assume by the pause that mm-hmm. you're...
Well, that's the gist of the finding, and I'm going to assume that you said you had some questions.
Right.
So if you want
right.
clarification on a particular point, I don't want to assume that I know what that is.
Okay.
So I'll just go ahead and let you ask.
That's fine. How much of this unreconciling do you think has to do with the IT issues that information technology issues that PERS has been going through?
Chair Crummell, I think that the IT situation at PERS has a large effect on why there are so many items in these clearing accounts. The Retirement Information Management System does not have the necessary functionality to compute a lot of the retirements that are going on. When people are divorced or certain situations of death benefits that go out, the system was not designed to take that into consideration, and so these calculations have to be done manually. When you have the manual calculation and then the system doesn't know how to calculate it, there's a difference there, mm-hmm. and that's what ends up showing up in these reconciling accounts. And because of the number of retirements and other situations that have gone on, when you throw in the IT factor into that and then the changes in the legislature, it just has created this backlog. So IT plays a very significant role in why there are so many items.
Okay. Do you think that, and maybe you don't know, but I'll ask anyway. Do you think that when they, because they're making the change over to a new system called J Clarity,
uh-huh.
do you think a lot of these issues will will sort of start becoming addressed in a more timely fashion when, as JClarity comes online and is fully implemented?
Chair Crummell, that is something that PERS would probably need to address in specific. JClarity is an entirely new system,
right,
that is being used to account for the new retirement plan, the defined contribution plan. Mm-hmm. The retirement information management system that we're talking about was for the old plan or the retirement or the defined benefit plan. Eventually, as far as my understanding goes, that information, I think PERS intends to eventually migrate to JClarity and use JClarity as their main system. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that's actually going to happen or if they're developing plans otherwise, I'm not really certain. But the information in these clearing accounts, if it's migrated to JClarity and used in that system, will need to be cleaned up before it goes. So it's an issue that they're going to have to address one way or another.
Well, and considering that they told the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology that they would be cleaning a lot of this up, I would certainly hope that that will be the case. Because having $140 million in unreconciled clearing accounts is a little unnerving. I mean, that's a pretty good sized chunk of change. The other thing that in their response that they had put, or said, was that management anticipates having outstanding items older than 6 months cleared from the reconciling accounts no later than June 30th, 2009. 2009 sounds like a long ways off. I know it's only 4 years, but it sounds like such a long ways off. Do you have any indication that that they could potentially do this quicker? Because you know, some of these accounts, you know, you made mention are they've been in their clearing accounts for more than a year. Mm-hmm. And is there really that many of them that they have to, that it would take that long to clear them?
Chair Crummell, in looking at these clearing accounts, we did some analysis of not only the dollar amounts that were included in them, but the number of items. And we looked just very generally at the types of items that are in there. And there's several thousand that are included in these. Some of them are going to be easy fixes, and some of them are going to take quite a bit of research and time to do. Whether or not, you know, June of 2009 is a reasonable time frame, I don't know if I could attest to whether or not that is, but, you know, that's kind of up to PERS how they handle it. I do know that it's going to take staff to clear these items, whether or not PERS has the resources to do that or whether they're seeking to get that. That's something that you would need to discuss with PERS and ask them directly.
Representative Brown.
Would the, if these are unreconcilable and they're in, and you say over several thousand different items or accounts, would this possibly create an overpayment to an account?
It's possible, and that's one of the things that made us uncomfortable and, you know, through the steps of the last couple of years has become a reportable condition, is there may be no errors, no incorrect benefits going out, but PERS does not know and we're not able to tell. I would suspect that there are some errors just given the volume of data, but the magnitude of those and, you know, whether or not there even are any, I can't say, but that's one of the risks, is when you have these reconciling items, there's some differences, and if you don't know what they're for, there's a potential that member accounts could be overstated or understated, that payments going out could be over or understated, a person has been deceased, their beneficiaries have all been paid, but the system still shows that they have an account balance in the system. So there's a lot of variables that play, and it's possible that members could be over or underpaid or their account balance is incorrect, but we just don't know.
It can really create some problems for down the road. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes, and I do know that with regards to PERS and their information technology issues that they have been complaining about the retirement information management system, or RIMS as it's been referred to, is because of its age and because of the limitations that you have, that there's a lot of workarounds and other things that the staff has had to do, it really does slow their processing down. We've also, over in the information management committee, we found that over the course of the past 8 years, we have, as a legislature, we have thrown a lot of money into this RIMS system, and we've not gotten anything back. There's now been a change of IT directors for PERS, and I think that those the continual expenses of expending of dollars into a system that is not going to work is will cease. And they finally exercised the went through the exercise of insanity long enough. You know, that's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. They finally did that long enough and have decided to go a different direction, which I think is going to be expensive, though. And that's the thing. It's expensive both in terms of the system that they're trying to put in place, but it's also expensive from the standpoint of having these unreconciled accounts and having as Amy was talking about, a member that, you know, died, or the beneficiaries have been paid, but there's still an account balance. You know, is the account balance real, or is it? Or is it not? And then the other side to that is, what happens if there's a deficit now in the account? Were the beneficiaries overpaid? And is the system owed money back? And that being the case, first of all, how much heartbreak is that going to cause for a beneficiary trying to repay that? And second of all, how much is it costing the state because of unrelinquished money's coming back?
Yeah. You would think that there must be the technology out there in the private sector, because there's a lot of money in PERS to deal with and a lot of accounts, but then there'll be that technology out there in the private sector someplace is dealing with probably a great deal more money than this too. And
That's one of the reasons why I think PERS decided to go with J Clarity, is because J Clarity actually is a benefits accounting program that's been used by other benefits managers that are quite a bit larger than PERS, or at least about the same size. And I think that's one of the reasons why they decided to finally quit beating their head against the wall. The one thing that you find in the information technology arena is that they suffer a lot from what is called the NIH syndrome. NIH stands for not invented here. So if it wasn't thought of by them, it can't be a very good idea. And the problem that you get with these, with some of the IT managers, particularly at the state level, is that if they didn't think of it, it must not be a very good idea. And this is a special sort of a program that's never been dealt with in the private sector, so it can only be handled by redesigning and developing the program from inside. And that's just simply not the case.
Those individuals then should get to answer the phone whenever the people call them, or know where their money's at.
Well, and as I mentioned, the IT manager that PERS used to have, the operating board there being used to have, has now gone to greener pastures somewhere else. Okay. They have a new IT manager, and he is working very effectively with the Information Resource Management Division of Department of Administrative Services to make sure that they can bring this system back into line. So that is a huge issue, and I think this points directly to, as I read it anyway, felt that, and with the information, background information that I have on the technology side, this points directly to the need for this the J Clarity system to move forward, which was approved last year by the emergency board, as well as the Joint Legislative Information Management Technology Committee. Is that the only thing on PERS that you had? Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Members, do you have any other questions at this particular point that you would like to have Kathy or anybody in her staff address, or anything that hasn't been talked about today? I would encourage us to... Kathy, is there anything else that you wanted to... that you or your staff wanted to... talk about?
We are here at your disposal, so
okay.
Anything you find of interest, we'd be happy to talk about.
I appreciate that. You didn't bring anybody that did the corrections stuff with you by any chance, did you?
That manager is no longer at our office, but the staff that worked on it is, and we could gather questions if you'd like.
Okay. The there was a couple of things that that I found with, as I was reading through this, that I found with the Department of Corrections, and let me just sort of bring those up. And that is one of the things that you had mentioned was mail opening procedures. From your perspective, as a, and I know the recommendation from Audits Division was that there should, the department should use two permanent employees for mail opening. This is members. This is on page 62, by the way, and it's finding number 04-7. And that they're currently using inmates to open departmental mail, and there was a question that the Audits Division had raised relative to checks and money that were in there and the security of those monies and that sort of thing. The department in their response said that they agreed with the recommendation. But they were doing a 30-day, going to do a 30-day evaluation of incoming mail, and that once, and they said here, and this is under B on page 63 at the top of the page, it says, once that level of risk is determined, the department will work with its internal audit staff to review compensating controls that could include establishing a mail log process, rotation of the mail opening duty, and additional supervision of the mail opening process. I think what I'm sort of reading into this is the ability to continue to use inmates for this type of work I think they're probably trying to save money, but at the same time have the controls in place. Since this came out, have you heard from, number one, I guess, have you heard from the department? Because I kind of like their idea there. Mm-hmm. Have you heard from the department as far as how that evaluation has come out, or has there been any kind of follow-up, or does that just wait until next year?
Mr. Chair, we'll find out definitely when we go back about July of this year. We will follow up on this. This particular response we just received, you know, I think within the last 2 weeks or so.
Okay.
So this is where they're at currently.
Okay.
And so we will be following up with them, but I have not heard, you know, where in the process they are on this.
Okay. From your staffing standpoint, then, is this a are there compensating controls that can be used? I mean, does this look like, so from your standpoint as an auditor, is this something that looks like it's feasible? Realistic, can be done?
Mr. Chair, depending on how they do it, it can be done. But you wouldn't want two inmates by themselves doing this, so.
Right.
I would.
No, I understand that. Yeah. That's
but, you know, again, like I said, we will, you know, take a look at what they are doing for those compensating controls.
Okay.
It is good labor, and in fact, I don't know if I should confess to this, but the Secretary of State's office does use inmate labor to answer some phones for us. So, you know, it is.
Well, and so does DMV.
Right.
And we know that. Matter of fact, there's been some criticism about, you know, personal records that DMV has then being in the hands of felons.
So
it's a real touchy issue. But I ask that because you know, earlier when Mr. Weatherspoon was talking about you know, the other cash handling issues around DHS, and that there really are no, you know, compensating controls. I'm just wondering if this is something that sounds like it might be reasonable. It, me reading it as a layperson, looks like it could be, but I'm just, you know.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think it's possible. You know, again, it just depends on how they set it up. So.
Okay. One of the things that I think we have found from this, because we talked about this with particularly with forestry, we've talked about it with DHS, talking about it a little bit here with corrections, and I think some of our other larger departments, and that is around the issue of cash management and cash controls and cash handling. And What I'm really concerned about is the amount of training that our management staff in these agencies is getting around these issues. And if they're not being trained, if the management staff isn't being trained, or they don't know this stuff going in, that's a real flaw in the system, because it really opens the opportunity for someone to be putting their fingers in the state cookie jar, for example, and I'm concerned about that, and making sure that we have the internal controls in place so that we're not having a higher risk. And when we're talking about, as DHS, Mr. Weatherspoon mentioned, $80 million, it's like Senator Dirksen said in the 60s, couple, $80 million here, $80 million there, $80 million somewhere else. Pretty soon, you're talking about real money.
With inflation, we can talk about a lot more.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, he was talking about billions when he was talking about it, because he was at the federal level. But I think that it is something that we need to really pay attention to in terms of our agencies and how they're. And that's one of the things that I'm sort of getting out of this statewide audit report. Are there any other comments or questions for Kathy or her staff? What I would like to do then is just urge everyone on the committee to, at your leisure, review this, have the information sort of in the back of your mind, know that this is a resource, because as we go on through the rest of the session, looking at agencies, particularly with DAS and Department of Administrative Services and that sort of thing, we may find that this is a real useful tool for us. And so, thank you, Kathy, again, for bringing this to us. And by the way, members, I would let you know that this is hot off the press. This has just been released by the Secretary of State's Audit Division. And we are the first committee to have gotten the first look at it. So thank you very much. Appreciate it. So if there's nothing else before us, then with that, we will stand adjourned until Tuesday. Thank you.